one of the things I enjoy most about my job is that opportunity I have to innovate, to try things, to push boundaries.
Welcome to Series 3 of Greater Than 11%, a podcast whose aim is to educate, inspire, and demystify creative careers, all the meanwhile promoting some awesome women and non-binary folk.
For episode 90, we are joined by Amy Smith, head of talent for the Oscar-winning, world-renowned animation and visual effects creative studio, Framestore. Amy has worked in talent-focused roles within the visual effects industry both in the UK and Canada for 20-plus years, although it wasn't her first choice. When she was at school, she had her sights set on being a volcanologist, but some less than encouraging career advice saw her set off to university to study English literature. On graduating, she worked a few admin and office-related jobs before finding her way into a HR department. Enjoying it, she built up her knowledge and skills and then moved into recruitment and then talent management within the creative sector. Amy is super passionate about diversity and actively engaged with schools, college and universities to provide careers advice and support for the visual effects and creative industries. She's also a non-executive director for Access VFX, a global industry-led non-profit made up of companies, industry bodies and educational establishments in the VFX, animation and gaming industries. Amy, I'm really looking forward to learning more about your career and your active focus and contribution to diversifying the VFX sector. What a joy to welcome you to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you very much, Renee. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm going to dive straight in, and I'm wondering if you could talk about and explain what it is Head of Talent actually does and what the responsibilities of the role are.
Yes, of course. I would say that there are two parts to my job, really. So the first part is that I oversee all of our global recruitment. So Framestore has offices all around the world in Canada, the US, India and Australia as well now. And I oversee the global recruitment team, making sure that a candidate for Framestore has the same, hopefully great experience of Framestore, no matter where in the world they're applying, that we're, you know, making sure that we follow best practice in all of those different regions, that we're finding the best candidates in all of those regions. So overseeing all of that work. And then the other part to my job is retention, essentially. So once we found all of our amazing people to join the company, how do we get them to stay? What makes Framestore a place that people want to come to work every day, where they feel that they're getting a satisfying career, they're getting the development opportunities they want, all of those things. So that's what my role is. And obviously that means that I work with a lot of the other departments in the company. So obviously I work with all of the sort of artist and production departments, but I also work with things like our HR team, our facilities team, our training team. All of those departments obviously have an influence on how people feel about Framestore as a company and a place to work. So I collaborate really closely with all of the departments within the company, which is one of the things I really like about the job, because I get to work with almost everybody, which is great.
Sounds like a super busy role as well, with lots of different, like you said, contacts and touch points.
Yeah, it can be.
And what skills would you say are needed for the role?
For me, one of the really key skills, I think, is, and the way I like to sort of think of my job, is that I'm a connector, as in there are lots of people in a business the scale of ours doing things in their own departments to make improvements, to make changes, and they don't necessarily always have the time or think to look outside of their department and see what other people are doing. And I think because my role does intersect with all these different departments, I have the ability to make connections. Oh, facilities are working on that thing. That relates to that thing marketing are doing over there. Let me point you at each other and help you work collaboratively on that. So sort of spotting connections like that and being that connective tissue is a really important skill in this role, just sort of paying attention to everything that's going on and thinking about where there could be efficiencies or where there could be really beneficial partnerships across the business. I think the other key part of my role is to be a real champion for other people. You know, my role isn't about my role. Really, if I'm doing my job right, no one should know that I'm there almost. You know, it's that kind of job. My job is about championing other people in the business, whether that's new entrants coming in and why they're amazing, or whether that's championing someone who has done something amazing in the business, or championing a new initiative that someone's rolling out. Because the role is all about sort of helping to create, sustain, build the culture that we have in the company. And so that involves making sure that people are aware of other people, initiatives, things that are happening. So I think being someone who's really passionate about supporting and promoting other people is a really important skill. And then, of course, as you said, it is quite a busy role. So I do think you have to be quite organized as well.
So I'm wondering if you could now talk about a little bit more detail about what your journey was arriving up into this point. I know I kind of mentioned a few things in the introduction, but it'd be really great to know kind of what the process was to arriving, working at such, like, you know, a creative powerhouse and being the kind of head of talent. Like, what was that journey for you?
It's a really interesting journey because, as you said in the introduction, I started off my career really having absolutely no idea what I was going to do, because the thing that had most interested me at school, I'd been put off by a careers advisor. And so I'd done my degree and got to the end of it and realized that I was qualified to do precisely nothing except read books, which isn't, you know, it's a nice life skill, but it's not massively helpful in the job market. So as you said, I was applying for sort of office admin jobs. I wasn't getting anywhere. And I ended up, I think, as a lot of young people do when they're starting out, you just need money at a certain point. You know, I just need someone to pay me some money because otherwise I can't survive. And so I got a job in a supermarket on the checkouts. And it was them who actually introduced me to the world of HR, because in working on checkouts, they said, actually, we've got a job going for a personnel assistant, as they called it then. Would you be interested? And I didn't know anything about HR or personnel, but I figured it had to be better than working on the checkout. So I took the job and discovered I actually really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed interacting with everyone within the store and helping people and making those connections. But I didn't really enjoy the retail environment. And so I started applying for other HR assistant jobs. And that's when I got offered the job at Framestore as HR assistant. And I knew nothing about Framestore when I joined. They had a website. It didn't really leave me any the wiser because I didn't really understand what they did. But I took the job. And in those first few weeks, I got introduced to a couple of the artists whose job it was to sort of explain to me what they did so that I had some understanding. And I became absolutely fascinated. I think at the time they were working on another series of the sort of walking with stuff. It wasn't Walking with Dinosaurs. It was just after that, but it was Walking with Spacemen or Walking with one of those. And I was like, oh, I know what this is. I've seen this program. Oh, this is amazing. And they were absolutely fascinating. And one of the things that was really key was they were so passionate about what they were doing. And in a retail environment, you don't meet very many people, particularly in a supermarket, I think, who are really passionate about what they're doing. It's a job. It pays their bills. It's fine. They've got no problem with it, but they're not passionate about it. And it was really revelatory to me to be around people who felt that way about work. And so I stuck it out, really. And I kept working in HR and I worked my way up. And then I was getting really involved with the sort of entry level people at Framestore, both sort of helping them on board from an HR perspective and answering that, you know, sort of being their backup and answering their questions. Because at the time there were only 250 of us at Framestore and we were all in London. So it was a much smaller company. And so I was much more involved in sort of helping them. And it made me realize that it was sort of the recruitment aspect that I really enjoyed, because I enjoyed that feeling of giving people that opportunity, you know, giving them that opportunity to sort of really work for a company they really wanted to, on the kind of projects they really wanted to. All those kind of things were the things I really enjoyed, rather than perhaps the sometimes less appealing side of HR, you know, things like disciplinaries or redundancies, or, you know, the things where you have to give people bad news. You know, I think, like most people, I didn't enjoy that side as much as I enjoyed the sort of more positive side in recruitment. And so then I started focusing on recruitment, and that was when other opportunities sort of started coming my way. Because I think when you're in recruitment, you become more visible externally to the company, obviously. And so I got offered an opportunity to join a much smaller visual effects company. There were only sort of 50 of them, to help them with their recruitment, which I did for a couple of years. And then I got asked to come out to Vancouver to work for another visual effects studio that was just sort of ramping up out there. So I did that for a few years. And then Framestore asked me back. So I came back because I'd always loved Framestore, and I didn't ever leave because I was unhappy. I just left because there was a different opportunity on the table and I wanted to try different things. But I very happily came back to Framestore 10 years ago now, and came back as head of recruitment for London and Canada originally. And then as the company's grown since I've been back, I've sort of taken on more and more responsibility. I was lucky. I ended up in a company whose work I really love. I've always enjoyed that behind the scenes, behind the curtain side of things. When I was at university, I was part of a theatre group, and I always was the backstage manager because it was that side of it. It was all the running around in the wings and people losing props and costumes not being right and stuff that I really enjoyed about it. You know, the stuff that the audience doesn't see. And I kind of, that's sort of what really appealed to me about visual effects as well, is, you know, we get to see all the stuff that the audience don't see as to how that project really came together. So I'm endlessly fascinated, and I'm also endlessly amazed by the artists. They are so phenomenally talented, and I'm always so upset when, you know, you see a review that says, oh, the CG in this is terrible, because people have no idea the amount of hard work that's gone into that, and that often the reason it's terrible is nothing to do with the talent of the artists, and it's just to do with the creative direction of the project itself. I get so much energy from the guys around me, from the artists, and their talent and their passion for what they do. It's amazing.
I think it would be great now to sneak in this question. And I'm wondering, and I loved that whole notion. It kind of made me start thinking about what HR do and how important brand management and talent recruitment is. And that whole, all the behind the scenes stuff that happens to make a culture that often isn't seen, like you said, running around with all the props backstage and making sure everything happens. It's such a good analogy for what you do as well, you know, in kind of your day job. But I thought it'd be really great if it's possible, if you could maybe give us an overview at a high level of like a project coming into Framestore and then how it's kind of pulled together. And I'm just thinking of like budding animators or creatives or artists that are wanting to work more in visual effects or gaming, kind of what that process is. And I was thinking like Mary Poppins Returns would be like maybe a good example, or another example that you want to talk about, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Although actually the process is pretty similar, I would say, from project to project. It doesn't vary a huge amount. So what I'm about to say would probably apply to most of our big projects anyway. I'll talk about film because it's very different on the advertising side, and I'll touch on that slightly. But talking about sort of a big film project, obviously, the scale that Framestore is, we're not cost effective as a business to work on something like an indie film or whatever, because we're just too large in scale to be cost effective for that kind of client. So the first thing to say is our clients as a company like Framestore are the big film studios that you've all heard of. So our clients are Warner Brothers, they're Disney, they're Marvel, you know, all the big film studios that we're aware of as the general public. So in the same way we're aware of them, they're obviously aware of us. There are very few visual effects studios at the scale of Framestore. There's maybe five or six that are that sort of big. And so typically, we don't need to do a huge amount of sales. I mean, we do. We go out to visit them regularly. We send them updated reels of our sort of work that we've done recently and those kind of things. But we don't sort of have to pitch, if you like, for every single project. Typically, someone like a Marvel or whatever will come to Framestore and go, okay, here's our next project, here's the visual effects script kind of thing. And they may have in mind a particular sequence or package of work that they actually want us to look at, or they may give us the whole script and say we should bid for the bits we want. That can vary from client to client, show to show, depending on what they've sort of got in mind. But we will then do that. So then we will then sit down and we'll look at either the package they've asked us to look at, or we'll look at the whole project and figure out what we want to do. And that's a combination of deciding what work we want to do creatively, because obviously we want to make sure as a company that we're giving our artists the most interesting work to work on, because that's important for their motivation. It's also, as you said, important for our employer brand and our ability to attract people, is that we get interesting work. But we also look at our resources. So obviously we have a pool of artists already internally. They will be divided across multiple projects already. So, you know, for example, right now we've got 23 film projects in the business right now. So, you know, all of our artists are busy. So we look at actually what kind of work do we have capacity to take on, you know, in the schedule the client wants to do this work. Do we have most availability in animation, and so we should bid for some animated characters? Or do we have most availability in our environments team, and so we should bid for an environments package? Or so we'll make all of these kind of assessments about both the creative that we want to do, but also the resources that we have available. And then we will put our bid into the client for that work. So this is what we want to do, this is how much it will cost you, and there'll be a period of negotiation. But assuming that we then win that work, there's all the contracting to go through. And then again, depending on the client and depending on the kind of project, we might get the opportunity to be involved on set. So our visual effects supervisor and or others may go out on set. We may even be involved before that. So at Framestore, we have a department we call pre-production services, and that includes a concept art team. It includes a virtual production team, which is a really new thing. So think LED screens on set and actors performing in front of them. It includes a pre-visualization and a post-visualization team as well. So we might even be involved in all of that work on a project before they even go and shoot on set, or our first involvement might be on set by sending out a visual effects supervisor to help them shoot. It sort of depends how visual effects heavy the project is. So thinking about Mary Poppins Returns, obviously there was a lot of visual effects in that film. You've got a lot of characters, you've got a lot of digital environments, etc., etc. So we were definitely involved with the filming of that project. But equally, we've just finished work recently on the new Downton Abbey film that's coming out, and obviously that's not a visual effects heavy film, so we weren't involved on set in that for that project because there was no need. They could film that and send us the work afterwards. So it kind of depends on the scale. You have to think of visual effects in the same way as a factory. And I don't mean that in a bad way. What I mean is, in a factory, you have your factory line, and every person on that line has a very specific task they do. You know, this person adds the nuts and bolts, this person does the painting, this person attaches this thing. And that's exactly how visual effects works as well. It's a very specialized pipeline. So we have people who do specific tasks that all come together to make the image you see on screen. So if I take a computer generated character as an example, first of all, obviously we get the footage that they've shot on set. And hopefully, if we're adding a digital character, they have filmed in front of a green screen, but they may not have, they may have just filmed without. But we then have a whole department who is responsible for making sure that the footage that comes in from on set is separated out into the layers that we're going to need to be able to add our computer generated elements later. We then have someone who models our computer generated character. So that's exactly as it describes. They sculpt them essentially inside the computer. We then have someone else who will put in the skeleton and the muscles and all of the sort of internal anatomy of that character that then allows our animators to be able to make them move. We have a separate department who will effectively, if you want to think of it like that, color in the outside of that character, but they also add, we call them texturing, because they also do exactly that. They add texture to the character, because obviously skin, clothing, everything isn't smooth. It all has texture as well as color. So they will add all of that detail. We have another department who will add fur, who will add cloth, who will add hair. All of those details, our animators make the move. Then we have a department who will add any effects that are required. So let's say it's a magical creature, and so they can create magic. So that magic will be added by our effects team. It then has to go on to our lighting department, because when, you know, I'm sure everyone listening is aware that when you film on set, there's obviously studio lights, or there's outdoor lights if they're filming outside. And our digital character has to look like it was under those same lights as well. So our lighting team will add the light back to our digital character so it looks like it was filmed in the same place. And then our compositors take everything they filmed on set and everything that we've made in the computer and put that all back together to make the final image. Now, of course, if we left all of those artists to do all of that by themselves, we would probably never meet a client schedule ever. And we would probably be endlessly tweaking these things because an artist is never happy with their work. So on top of all of that, we also have our production team, who are exactly like the production team you might have for live action filming, but they just work internally with our teams. And it's their job to keep that factory line, to keep all of those people on time, on target, making sure they know what they're supposed to be doing from day to day, making sure that we're hitting the budget for the client. They're the ones getting feedback from the client, feeding that back to the artist, making sure that we're hitting those notes. So we have a big sort of project management piece on top, managing all of that. And then, of course, underneath that, we have a big technology piece, making sure that all of those people can work together effectively. Because as I've described, a single digital character might have 20, 25 different artists who all touch that character in some way or another. And so they've got to be able to share that information. And if one of them makes a change, the others need to be able to see it and all of those things. So there's a big sort of data management piece that goes on in there to enable all of those artists to work together. So then you've got all of the sort of technology teams sitting underneath holding that up as well. So it's a big, big, big machine getting a project through Framestore. And, you know, we are endlessly iterating and trying to get more efficient in how that machine works.
It's so amazing because it's, you know, explaining the process, even when you're aware of it. Like, I'm struck like how collaborative it is as well. That notion of, like you said, there's like 20, 25 people that may touch a character or a certain scene or something like that. And it goes through all those kind of iterations. And yeah, it just strikes awe. And like you said, keeping that machine running, you know, the production team are saviors, they're the unsung heroes.
Absolutely, they are.
That was amazing. Thank you so much. And I'm sure, I know that many people that are listening to this are interested in visual effects and animation. So I know that will have been absolutely fascinating for them to hear. I'm wondering, how does it differ? You mentioned working within advertising. So how does it differ when you're working on like a concept or a project for a brand and it's like, you know, going out in kind of TV or, you know, in cinema in terms of adverts?
Obviously, the sort of upfront process is very different because there are potentially thousands and thousands of clients out there, and our advertising team do both different ways that you could work in advertising. So they will work to an advertising agency brief if that brand is working with an agency rather than direct to a creative studio like ourselves. So we work with advertising agencies, but we also work direct to brand or direct to client as well, again depending on the client. So that means there's a lot more effort goes into the sales side of our advertising team, because they have to be out there and they have to be constantly talking to the big brands whose work we want to do and who have the biggest budgets that, you know, because obviously the most interesting visual effects work from an advertising point of view is going to be with the brands who have the biggest budgets, obviously. So yeah, there's a lot more sort of upfront sales work that goes on in our advertising team. But then our advertising team also work across much greater variety of kinds of projects as well. So there's your classic, as you said, TV advert, and they do those, and that's, you know, that's where Framestore started 30 odd years ago, was with TV adverts. So that's absolutely our bread and butter. And there's things like music videos and things, which again are very sort of bread and butter for Framestore. But then they might also work on a VR experience or an AR experience, or they might create a big interactive installation for a brand, or they might even create a theme park ride. Or so there's all sorts of different applications for advertising a brand, I guess, that aren't just your traditional screen that you think of. They're all screens, or ultimately all the work we make goes on a screen somewhere, but they're very different types of screens. And so that means that the artist pool, if you like, within advertising work a little bit differently as well. It's still they're still specialists, and they still pick up certain parts of creating the work, but they might, I sort of describe them as T-shaped people, and by that I mean they have a broad understanding of lots of things, but then a specialism within one thing, so it makes them the shape of a T. And so yeah, so our advertising artists kind of like to be a bit more exploratory in their skill set, I would say, rather than really just focusing on one thing and becoming an expert in that. They like to try different things and they like to get stuck into different kinds of projects. And obviously the turnaround of the projects is much faster as well. So in advertising, it sort of suits someone who likes, you know, who sort of gets bored doing the same thing over and over and over and over over a long time and likes to constantly be doing different things, because, you know, the longest advert we might work on might be sort of 3 months in duration. And that would be something like a big Christmas advert or something like that, whereas most of them are sort of anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks in duration, whereas a big film will work on for 9 to 12 months before it comes out at the cinema. So the timeline is very, very different.
Wow. And I guess what's really interesting about that, and I kind of hadn't thought about that when I was asking about kind of adverts, is like all the opportunities that tech development brings, like VR and, you know, screens that you can interact with. And I hadn't even thought about theme park rides. So that's super exciting. And it's really interesting when you're explaining it, I was definitely thinking of the different personalities, you know, that people that like that specialism and that intense focus and like becoming a master of that craft, and then someone that likes to know a lot and then focus on something.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're aware of like why I started Greater Than 1%. And it was because, especially within the creative industries, there was a lack of diversity. And as in your role, and obviously for finding talent and recruiting, I'd be really interested to hear how Framestore kind of seeks out and hires and retains diverse talent. Like, what's the process and what's the kind of ambitions?
Yeah, so the ambitions is to have Framestore represent the communities in which we work. So, you know, in London, that would be to have, you know, an equal gender split and to be 30% ethnic minority and all of those things. You know, that's the goal, is we want to represent the communities in which we work. The way we go by that is many, many, many layered, because there is no, as I think, as we all know, there is no magic bullet to solve this problem. For us, I think the added challenge we have, so we are part of the creative industries, and the creative industries have their challenges with diversity. There's issues around people not perceiving them as proper jobs. You know, the creatives are all freelance gigs and there's no job security and you don't get paid well and you have to do it because you love it and all that stuff. So there's all those sort of preconceptions about creative jobs that cause problems for the creative industries. But then, of course, as we've said, we're also a technology company. And as we all know, the tech industry has its issues with, you know, being largely predominantly white, middle class and male. So we happily sit at the connection of those two problems. So we actually start really early. So we start with primary schools all around the world, and we go out to primary schools. And really our goal at primary schools is just to try and keep people interested in the right subjects for a bit longer, because there's lots of evidence out there that says girls in particular start checking out of the sciences and maths and things like that from as early as the age of 7, because they don't perceive that they're, you know, they're interested or that they're right for them. So we start that early, just trying to encourage them to stay at it and see the applications of those skills beyond the stereotype. You know, not all scientists wear lab coats. And so we try and encourage that. We're able to do that. It's one of the advantages of doing what we do, is we can go into a primary school with Paddington Bear and say, you like this film, don't you? Well, here's how science and maths came into play in this, you know, and that really helps, I think. And then beyond that, I have been really heavily involved in rolling out apprenticeships for visual effects, because one of our other challenges was the only way to really develop a visual effects portfolio for a long time was to go and get a visual effects degree. And as we know, degrees are not very inclusive, and there are huge swathes of society that either don't want to do degrees or can't afford to do degrees, or for whom it's just not culturally something they're familiar with in their families, all those kind of things. So, well, I led for the industry on developing apprenticeships as an alternative to going to university, as a way to bring people into the industry where we trained them ourselves. So we took a latent interest and we developed that into a career for those young people. So that's been really important to improving the diversity of our pipeline. But then, of course, you know, all of these interventions trying to help keep women and people of colour interested in the subjects long enough that they get to an apprenticeship or they get to university or wherever they're going, and they then come into the industry. You've then also got to do the work inside the industry as well. well. And so at Framestore, we have a social equity board. So we call it social equity rather than diversity and inclusion. But yes, we have a social equity board that is made up from people right across the company from all our different locations, all different kinds of people whose job it is to try and make sure that everything we're doing internally is creating an inclusive environment where people feel that they belong, that people feel that they have the ability to develop their careers, that they see opportunity within the business. And again, we don't split the work of the social equity board by protected characteristic. I know some companies do, you know, they have a group that focuses on women and they have a group that focuses on people of color. But I think what that really overlooks is intersectionality and how important intersectionality is in this discussion. And so we actually split the work of our social equity board by stage in someone's career. So we have an attraction side. So that's all about the sort of recruitment entry level. We then have a retention side to the work, which is fairly self-explanatory. That's about, you know, keeping people in the business and helping them move from being entry level into sort of higher levels. And then we have a leadership side to the work, which is, again, not only how do we move people into leadership positions, but also how do we train those already in leadership positions to make sure that they are being inclusive as leaders and that that is front of mind, that they are aware of their own biases, that they're working to counter those, all those things. So that's sort of how we split the work of our social equity group in order that it takes account of, you know, the huge diversity of people there are at all of those stages of someone's career.
That's totally amazing. And I was just, I kind of got a little sidetracked, you know. I definitely want to touch on the social equity. I think that's such a great strategy to have. And I really liked that intersectionality plays a big part because, you know, it just can create further isolation or alienation if it's kind of just in like very neat is the wrong word, but distinct buckets, you know, and it's not taking into account the breadth of someone's experiences and backgrounds. But I got distracted thinking about, like, I love that you're playing the long game and going into primary schools. And I was wondering when you started that initiative and as if anyone has come knocking on the door of Framestore and said, when I was seven, you turned up at my school and you told me about Paddington Bear and I'm, you know, I'm desperate for an apprenticeship.
I haven't had someone as young as seven yet, but I have had someone who said when I was 12, who is now in the industry as an apprentice. So it, you know.
Yeah, totally answers my question. I just had seven in my head. But yeah, that's amazing. That must have felt incredible as well when that happened.
It's brilliant. And you know what? They didn't even get their apprenticeship at Framestore. And I don't care because that's not what it's about. You know, the fact is it's working and we're getting more people into the industry because although we're not freelance in the way people think of freelance in the creative industries, so people move around the industry and they choose to move sometimes because one studio has a particular project that they really want to work on or whatever. And so anyone coming into the industry is great as far as I'm concerned, because at some point they'll end up at Framestore, I'm sure, and that's awesome. It's definitely the long game, but I think it's the only way. You can't solve a diversity issue overnight. You can't just go, well, there are no diverse people in visual effect degree courses, there are no diverse people in visual effects college diplomas, so we're just gonna, what, you know, you've got to play the long game. It's, we've got to make them. If they're not there, how are we going to make them? And so that's what we're doing.
Yeah, I love that. And that's a big part of kind of my thinking and why I started the podcast, was like, if you don't have the information as well, how do you know what exists? You know, and it's that notion of being able to share and say, like, these roles are out here, this is what you need. And like, yeah, I love that. But also maybe on the apprenticeships, you know, if someone was interested in getting an apprenticeship with Framestore or elsewhere, you know, is there a way that they can find that information or how to contact you? Is it on the website or?
Yes, absolutely. So there's more information about the apprenticeship on the Framestore website. If you go to framestore.com/careers, you'll see that there's a link there to more information about apprenticeships. But if someone's really keen on that right now, actually what they need to do. So this is the other unique thing about the industry is, and I don't think many industries are thinking like this, but as a visual effects industry, we don't see hiring apprentices as competitive advantage. As in, if we start competing over 16 to 18 year olds, we've got bigger problems as an industry than being able to recruit. And so what we actually do is we actually recruit our apprentices as an industry. So we advertise that we're looking for visual effects apprentices, and we'll say these are the companies that are involved this year. We run our assessment day as an industry, and then we all make our offers on the same day. So if a potential apprentice, for example, is interesting to Framestore and ILM and the mill, then they'll get all three offers on that day. And then that person gets to make the choice about where they want to go based on how we've sort of sold ourselves to them, I suppose, because we just think that's really important. It's they're young. It's potentially their first job. They've got to make the right choice for them. And so we want to make this process feel, again, as inclusive as we can, and that they're joining, as I said, an industry and not just an employer. So all of that to say, we therefore have one place where people can go to find out more information about visual effects apprenticeships, and that's Next Gen Skills Academy. Their website is nextgenskillsacademy, all one word, .com. And on there, you'll see that one of their menu options is apprenticeships, and you can go there and you can register your interest to be told when we start advertising for the next cohort. And that should be sort of May time each year, because we take a cohort on in September every year. So we normally start advertising around May.
I think you guys are so forward thinking, so organized, and the ripples of what you're already doing now are starting to come back. But it feels like I said, that long term game and really thinking about how things will be in the future as well. I mean, that must feel quite exciting to be part of.
It's massively exciting. It's massively exciting to feel like we're building something. And honestly, when I get those odd emails saying, you know, thank you so much, you've made my career, I didn't even know this was an option, and now I'm doing it and it's awesome. Like, it's, that's the best feeling in the world. It really is, to feel like you've helped someone achieve their potential, achieve, you know, their dream. That's such a fabulous feeling. Nothing beats it. So yeah, it is great. As I said right at the start, getting them in at an entry level is only half the battle, right? You've then got to keep them, you've got to develop them, and you've ultimately got to help them get those leadership positions. So we're very conscious of that, and we're certainly not resting on our laurels going, great, we've got this pipeline running, this is going to be perfect. It does feel hopeful, which I think is at least a start.
Yeah, amazing. And I bet it must feel amazing to get those emails or just gain feedback. I'd love to hear more about, and I mentioned in the intro as well, that you're a non-executive director of Access VFX. So maybe talk a little bit more about that, because that feels like it's also very industry focused. Well, it is very industry focused, and it's a group of organizations coming together again to kind of change what's happening in the industry in relation to diversity.
Again, it's part of, I think, the visual effects industry being really forward thinking and much more collaborative than a lot of other industries, I think, are. There are companies, as I said, the scale of Framestore, who have people like me and resources to be able to work with primary schools, to run work experience programs, you know, these kind of things that can be helpful. But there are lots and lots and lots of very small employers in this sector as well, of, you know, 50, 100 people, who don't have the resources and don't have the ability, but they do have the will to want to change the industry and to want to improve the industry, particularly from a diversity point of view. And so again, it was a group of us coming together, led by Simon Devereaux, who was at the mill at the time and is now actually at Framestore as well, to say, well, how about we work collectively on this? Because it's sort of a similar story. If we're going into schools or colleges, or we're running a sort of roadshow, or we're going to the National Skills Show in Birmingham every year and talking to young people, there's no competitive advantage to that. It's only to the advantage of all of us to be doing that. And so let's work together on it, and let's make that more cost effective, but also let's make that have greater impact. You know, if we all work together, we have much greater impact and can reach many, many more young people, educators, parents, than if we all do it individually. And we can be more strategic with our time as well, and we can run things ourselves rather than being at the whim of a school inviting us in, for example. So that was why we decided to come together to form Access VFX. And we've done all sorts of things together as a group, from, like I said, running our own events. We took everything online, obviously, during the pandemic, and last year ran Young Animator of the Year and had some amazing entries online for that. We're hoping to run that again this summer. We've got our podcast that was massively popular during the pandemic, where we addressed all sorts of issues around employment, mental health, how to stand out while staying in, you know, how to get yourself seen online when physical events weren't a possibility, all these kind of things. So yeah, and then being a brand like Access VFX enables us to partner with other amazing organisations working in this space. So we've partnered with organisations like We Are Stripes and This Ability and Eric, who are all also working to improve diversity in the creative industry. So it gives us more influence to work together as a group.
Well, yeah, again, kind of like I was saying before, it's just so forward thinking, and I just can't think of any other industry. I'm sure there is others, but like in kind of my kind of universe that I know of that are kind of just really proactively working together. And yeah, it just sounds brilliant. Okay, so I'm going to go back to your career now that you've told us all this amazing information about, you know, what you do and how you're kind of looking at social equity and diversity within the visual effects sector. But I'm wondering if you could talk about maybe what one of the biggest challenges you faced in your career and how you overcame it.
There's always a really obvious one that stands out for me. So I mentioned earlier that when I left Framestore, the first time that I worked here, I went to a much smaller visual effects studio, and it was wonderful. And we were obviously, being a very small team, we were very close knit, but it was the kind of visual effects studio where we only had one project in at a time because of our scale. And after being there for sort of a couple of years or so, the one project we had in got pulled by the client because they decided they didn't want to make it anymore. And that was enough, sadly, to make the company go bust. And I was the sole HR person at that company. And so it was my job to be the person to tell everybody, including myself, that we were all now redundant and that no one had a job as of that afternoon. And then trying to help people, because obviously the company went bust, so there wasn't any money to pay anyone. So then helping people fill in the forms to try and claim their statutory redundancy, trying to help people with my connections in the industry to try and find other jobs, all of that. It was really, truly awful and horrible, and not something that I ever want to do again. I certainly didn't want to do it then either. And it was a real challenge for me psychologically, because to start with, I think I didn't really think about the impact on me or my career, because I was so focused on trying to help everybody else that I didn't really think about it. It was only once everyone else had sort of been sorted to an extent that I sort of sat down and went, oh, right, I also don't have a job. What am I going to do now? Because I'd really, you know, found my place in the creative industries, and I knew that was where I wanted to stay, but I wasn't sure where to go next, really. It took me a good 3 months to find another job. It wasn't a great time in the job market when all that happened. It was around the recession, sort of 2008. So it wasn't a great time to be looking for a job. It took a long time, and it was really hard to keep my mental health in the right place, I guess. And I went through so many applications where I didn't hear anything. And I think actually, in a way, it made me a better recruiter at the other side, that experience, because I learned how completely disheartening it is to keep applying for things and hearing nothing, or, you know, sort of getting a standard rejection. So, I think it's definitely made me more empathetic as a recruiter moving forward. And in the end, I did land on my feet, and I got an amazing job, which I sadly only did for a very short time, because, you know, it's like buses, isn't it? I finally, after 3 months, managed to get a job that I really liked. And then I got offered a job in Vancouver a couple of months later, which I couldn't really turn down. So it never rains, but it pours. The only way I could keep myself sane was to treat finding another job as if it was a job. So, you know, I set up routines, and I had a planner, and it was like, okay, today I am going to submit this many applications, even if it's for jobs that aren't quite what I'm looking for. I'm just going to treat this like a job, and, you know, I'm going to focus. I'm going to sit down certain times of the day and do it, and I'm not going to procrastinate, and I'm not going to, you know, sit around feeling sorry for myself. And that was sort of how I managed to pull myself out the other side in the end.
That sounds so tough. I mean, just making anyone redundant, even if, you know, for whatever reason it's difficult, but a whole team. And yeah, and then lend. I think it's true to your nature. And, you know, we've been chatting that you're very giving and very generous and very supportive. And to suddenly realize once you'd kind of given everything you could to everyone else, actually, that you needed to do something for yourself as well. That must have been really tough.
Yeah, it was. It was, yeah, not a nice time. But the interesting thing is, of all the companies and jobs that I've had over the years, the tightest bonds still to this day are with the people who worked at that company. Like, we still catch up with each other and we still all cheer for each other behind the scenes. It's really interesting how an experience like that can forge some of the strongest bonds, actually.
And I feel like you do, you take a very positive focus on everything that happens. I can see that already, which is a lovely segue into our next question. I mean, I think you've told us quite a lot about what you love about what you do, but I'd love to hear kind of your top things of why you love working in kind of recruitment and retaining amazing talent.
It's a really good question, isn't it? You so rarely sit back and reflect on what it is you really enjoy. But I think, first of all, on a personal level, one of the things that I enjoy most about working for Framestore specifically is that it's a company that really lets you create opportunity for yourself. My career is absolutely testament to that. I've said, why don't we do this thing? You know, why don't we get involved in apprenticeships? Why don't we roll out the first internship in the industry? Why don't we do this? And Framestore just goes, go on then. And so one of the things I enjoy most about my job is that opportunity I have to innovate, to try things, to push boundaries. And Framestore's never stood in the way of any of that. And so that's awesome. And I love that aspect of my job. I think I've already said, feeling like you're helping and supporting people to achieve their dreams as well is an amazing feeling, and definitely the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning is feeling like I've helped someone else achieve their full potential or their ability to do what they want to do. I do enjoy making connections. I do enjoy spotting opportunity and feeling like I'm part of creating a culture. I'm part of creating what Framestore is as a brand. I don't think I could work for a company where I was just a cog in a wheel and I didn't feel I was part of what that business is, if that makes sense. I just don't think I would thrive in that environment. It's a really intangible thing, but you definitely feel it when you're in a company that's like that, and you don't feel it when you're in a company that's not like that. And I've worked in companies where it's not like that at all. You know, the only person who's responsible for making that company what it is the person at the top, and no one else has any input. And it's not a nice environment. It's not somewhere I want to be.
So that collaborative element just ripples out through the organization, it sounds like, at Framestore, and like there's freedom to explore and be creative in whatever area you're working.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's really hitting the nail on the head, actually, is that even those of us who aren't in what you would think of as a creative department are able to be creative within the scope of our own roles. I think that's really true.
So you mentioned earlier on that you're an introvert and that to kind of get your energy back, you kind of need time away. But how do you fuel your own creativity? Like what we were just talking about, how do you keep that topped up so that you can keep going?
Partly, I am still massively curious about what all of our artists do. And so I will still go and sit with them and be like, tell me about what you've been doing. And I could listen to them talk for hours. So that definitely keeps my creativity topped up is witnessing theirs. Also, working with young people in the way, I do a lot with schools and things, and their energy and their enthusiasm for their futures and their passions and their funny ways and stuff really inspire me to want to do the best for them and be creative for them and help them find solutions. So there's that. And then sort of more traditionally creatively, I am a sort of, I guess, slightly frustrated artist at heart. I love all things sort of fashion and those kind of things. And I'm really into sort of pimping like clothes and all those kind of things. And I also am a big crafter as well. I, you know, do a lot of traditional crafts like knitting and sewing and things. So I have my sort of more traditional creative outlets as well, which I also find, you know, as an introvert, really help me top up that sort of creative itch, I guess, as well. So yeah, there's lots of different ways.
But I'm wondering, can you tell me what's coming up or what's next for you?
So what's next for me? I guess, is twofold. So within Framestore, there's a lot of focus on some of our newer offices. So our Mumbai office is really growing. And one of the things we really want to make sure is, particularly from a diversity point of view, is that, you know, a new studio gives you the opportunity to try and get things right from the start. And in India, gender diversity in particular is a really big deal. So we're trying really hard as a team to make sure we've got the best practices in place we can to try and ensure gender parity in India. And then the Australian team will be rolling under my remit very soon as well. So that's going to be a big challenge, trying to work out how you work at almost an opposite time zone to yourself and try and make that team still feel included and part of the company and that they understand what the Framestore culture is and that they're part of that. So that's going to be a really interesting challenge as well. And then externally to Framestore, there's still a lot of work that I want to do with governments and education around the world. One of my sort of real passions is that creative education pretty much globally is appalling and that respective governments and educators don't understand the importance of it, not just for the creative industries, but actually for people in general. And I do a lot of work in that sphere, trying to influence, persuade, support campaigns around creative education. So if you ask me about the sort of really long-term view of my career, I think definitely something in that ilk somewhere where it's, yeah, being involved in sort of politics around creativity and education is where I see myself eventually, but I don't know when or how, but yeah.
My God, I love that. And when you're describing all that and also the vision you have and the organisation, I look forward to hearing more about that in the future. Something I do before I wrap up every interview is I ask everyone to maybe suggest a job in the creative industries they know little about, and then I potentially could find someone in that role and we could talk about that and explain that. And the other element is to recommend a woman or non-binary person in the creative industry to interview.
I would love to hear more about a costume designer. I'm fascinated by costume design. I think it's amazing. And I think in another life, you know, that definitely it's something that I would have wanted to do. So yeah, and how you get into that, I've no idea how you get. I mean, yeah, all right, you can do a textile degree, but then I don't know how you get the opportunity. So anyway, that would be that. And then there's a woman I know who is an animation director called Marion Strunk. And she is a force of nature, and she is amazing, and she has been determined to make a success of her career since I've known her, and I've known her since she was like 19 years old, and her career has just flown because she's just on a mission and she's going to make it happen for herself and no one's going to stand in her way, and I admire her massively. So Marion would be my pick.
Great. Oh, well, I'll hit you up for her email address. I'd love to reach out and grab her. And definitely on the costume design. Actually, the first ever episode of Greater Than 11% is with a costume cutter who was working towards becoming, a costume designer. And she's one of my really good friends. And so, yeah, she changed her career in her 30s and went from kind of working within kind of admin and things like that, and then came to the UK and studied. And yeah, she got an Emmy a couple of years ago for the work she did on The Crown. So,
amazing. Really,
yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to go and listen to that then.
Yeah, for sure. Amy, thank you so much for your time today. I've just loved chatting to you. And I just, you know, I feel like I need to salute you for all the incredible work you're doing in the industry. Yeah, it's amazing.
No problem. It was a pleasure speaking to you as well.
Thank you for listening. Please do subscribe to where you get your podcasts to make sure you're up to date with any new episode drops. And you can also follow us on Instagram at GreaterThan11. A huge thank you to Eden Richards, who creates all Greater Than 11%'s artwork and edits this beautiful podcast.